Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, tales of environmental devastation and recovery. I'm delighted to re-host a learned druid, hermetic, Masonic initiate, John Michael Greer, author of over 50 books on esoteric traditions, nature, spirituality, and the future of industrial society, whose resonant erudition finds latest expression in this book that we want to honor today, The Ceremony of the Grail, Ancient Mysteries, Gnostic Heresies, and the Lost Rituals of Freemasonry. His splendid website is echosophia.net. Welcome, John Michael Greer.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on again.
Yes, not since Apocalypse Nut.
Right? It's been a little while, hasn't it? Yeah, you know, been a busy time.
Well, it is a busy time. And as always, you are so great at discerning, the inquisitional propaganda as we go through. But and then I love that. I call it the reality police, but the Inquisition, which we want to certainly delve into. But as we are speaking now, and then our astro chart for Berkeley, Mars is rising in the east. It's right on the eastern horizon, and it's just stationed. So
many appears direct. To
yeah, just a few hours ago at 8+ Gemini, which is the U.S. Uranus. So it segues to our last week's show with Robert Ovitz, really, really good on the Constitution as compost for experiment and actual democracy. Well, and it ties back to you. It's like, so it's time to go deep, 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 back down, you know, to address what's been bamboozling, but also to address what we've forgotten but must remember, right? Just one more little thing on Mars, and then I want to segue to everything. But, Percival is Mars. So Mars's Sabian symbol, old tradition of metaphors, is a quiver filled with arrows. So I like adding to that. Each one of us, Mars has gone backwards to reclaim this, a quiver filled with arrows, each one tipped with compassion, with tyranny as its target. So everybody, you can shoot off some practice rounds.
Well,
yeah,
if you've ever drawn a bow, you know that you draw back the arrow away from the target and then send it forward. I think that's what's going on right now with Mars. Mars has kind of backed up and drawn his bow, and now things are going to change.
I like it. And I love the retrograde apparent backwards motion as exactly that. You know, we pull the bowstring back, and the bowstring might say, I'm not making any progress. In fact, I'm going backwards. And the bow says, no, you're going to like this. Right.
Twing! And away we go,
And it's sextile Chiron, the civilizing influence. And I love my friend Deborah Falmouth saying, you know, in the West we think of the future in front of us and the past behind us. She says in the Middle East it's the reverse. We're gazing at the past in front of us. It's a good thing to try. And we're crafting the future by gazing at the caravan of our past mentors. Well, that's kind of what you're helping us to do,
works.
Right?
That metaphor works, not least because the future is, there's always something in the future that's going to spring up on you as a surprise. And if it's behind you, you don't see it sneaking up on you. So yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And then Mercury quintiles Neptune, may we be available to mystery. And as I was reading, so much of your splendid erudition is so resonant with myself. I mean, every name, I read that. I should reread that. You've given me, you know, a year anyway, it's so great. Mm-hmm. But I like also the model that just as we have endogenous receptors, you know, for cannabis and DMT and stuff, I think we have endogenous receptors for myth and guiding mystery.
Oh, yeah. The thing is, storytelling is the oldest human information technology. And the one that's hardwired into our nervous system at this point. If you take a moment to remember some of the nursery rhymes you learned as a very small child, I bet you have them word for word, letter from letter, and if you start reciting them, you'll get into the sing-song pattern that you used back in the day.
Mm.
Yeah, you see, that's the human capacity for oral memorization. We've got it. We had it for, what, like 2 million years. And so, yeah, the myths and stories, tales that have meaning, they're built into us. And the capacity to listen to them and learn from them and pass them on, that's one of the basic elements of being human.
So what's a nursery rhyme that comes to mind for you? I've got Mary, Mary, quite contrary, how do your cockles grow with a silver egg? I'm blowing it.
Yeah, one that I loved when I was a child, simply because it was so weird. How many miles to Babylon? 70 miles. Can I get there by candlelight? Aye, and back again. If your feet be quick and light, you can get there by candlelight.
Oh, I don't know that one.
You don't? Oh. Yeah, that was the first time I heard it. I was going, I want to know about this one.
That's the spookiest eerie, rather than ashes, we all fall
Isn't
down
it,
about
though?
The plague.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh yeah. Or the woman with the basket. Do you recall that one?
No.
No, there was an old woman tossed up in a basket 17 times as high as the moon, and asked if, this one I learned later, actually, and where she was going, I couldn't but ask it, to sweep the cobwebs. No, something, I've lost this one. That was not one of the ones in my childhood, but I got it from the annotated Mother Goose.
Right.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, so your resonant, pertinent erudition, I mean, tales of environmental devastation and recovery, may it be so.
Oh, yeah.
But
you
begin with, Jesse Weston and From Ritual to Romance. I'm like, I read that in 1970.
Oh, good,
God.
You read it. You
dust
admit
it off.
You read it. Oh, that book, that brilliant book, has been suppressed, sat on, ignored for all these decades now. It's absolutely crucially important, and it's embarrassing that so many people have run away from it.
Run away, meaning why? Because it's what?
Well, you'd think that it would be obvious. I mean, Jesse Weston was really, I think, the first major female folklorist to break into the until then all-male club of folklore studies. She was a pioneer in every sense of the word, but she was also dealing with occultism. And starting in the second half of the 20th century, there was a hard line drawn about that. We don't talk about occultism. Any scholar who is sufficiently, tarred with occultism, like G.R.S. Mead, gets thrown into the dumpster. We all stop talking about the fact that Yeats or, Ezra Pound were up to their eyeballs in occultism. No, we can't talk about that. That's verboten.
Right, but it's so interesting because when I start off, in 1970, I think for many of us ancient people now, but I'm like late teens, and that's when I decided to become an astrologer because
Sweet.
There was a brief salon and Andy Weil presiding, and we were reading all the occult stuff, right? That's what we went for. We were reading all the occult stuff as well as the Whole Earth Catalog and anything it said to read. But yeah, all of that. So the taboo we knew was the sacred. I mean, that was just the climate and part of the kind of zeitgeist, I think, of the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, they're basic. The 70s were a very strange time because for a while, a lot of very interesting stuff, and that was true in the late 70s also. I'm a little younger than you are. I graduated from high school in 1980. But all through the course of the 70s, I was, during the era of lurid paperbacks for sale in every grocery store and so on, and a lot of them on occult subjects. And so, yeah, there was all of this stuff sort of boiling out, and then in the 80s, the lid got slapped back down on it.
Yes, very interesting, right? And then also homage to the cranks who carried the torch. I mean, a lot of the people I studied with, Isabel Hickey,
you
working class.
Isabel Hickey, I didn't know that.
I did.
Oh, her two books are great.
She's a hoot. Right, no. We were very very tight in a complex dynamic. But because I'd just gotten back from London, and she was like, she's coming here, there. But I was always grateful to her because she carried the torch again, working class, Boston, astrology class, heavy chain smokers, and doing what could be done, carrying the torch through the dark ages of rational dismissive. But But when so you start off with Jesse Weston, and I love, you know, throughout the book, it's so satisfying to be liberated from the reality police over and over again by you. You talk about inquisitional propaganda, you know, mm-hmm. and A.E. Wade as a Christian occultist who mistranslated Eliphas Levy. And I go, I knew it! I knew it! Oh, that's such a relief. Yes. I must get your book on, because Eliphas Levy, we will introduce him as with William Morris and many other people. But mm-hmm. Eliphas Levy, to know, to dare, to will, and to be silent, yeah, had all his books, but Transcendental Meditation, or magic, transcendental magic. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I don't know. But you say it was A.E. Wade's.
Wade did a horrible job of translating it. That's why Mark Miketuk and I ended up doing our own translation, just because we were so frustrated by Wade's garbled version of it. And also Wade's smug dismissal of so many of Levy's points. He was constantly putting in these snarky footnotes saying, you know, that's not true. And well, no, Arthur, you just don't know as much as Levy did.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And also just know from the early conflicts, you know, reading, studying Paul Foster Case's tarot, and the Builders of the Adytum and whatnot. And, and they were saying, don't trust Wade. He puts in these intentional mistakes in the tarot and all kinds of, so I knew he was sketchy,
We definitely have some territory in common. I did the Bodo work also back in the day.
Oh,
yeah.
Right. Hail Frater. Hail Frater J, right? I'm your Sora RC. Still find it adorably clean. And right back in that time, Andy Weil used to joke, you know, again, you know, the cheesy ads in cheesy magazines would say, you know, thoughts have wings, we have the secrets, the Rosencrantz, the Rosicrucians, right? And Andy would say,
not a religious organization, yes.
Right. Yeah. Well. Andy would say the joke is they do. Anyway, so you know, in its carnival trappings. But back to you.
No. Mercury. That's Mercury all over the place. He loves his con artistry. He's the Lord of Wisdom and the Lord of con jobs.
He's also stationing right now.
That's right.
That goes direct on the 18th on the U.S. Eris.
That will be decorative. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm having a great time. I always use Mercury retrogrades to edit and to revise. And so I've got a whole bunch of stuff to do, and I've been chugging through that during the retrograde. It always works just fine.
Well, a great central part of your dedication is, you know, remembering what we've forgotten, and that it stirs in us. And you do start off with mystery, you know, from ritual to romance, and then mystery and the Eleusinian mysteries, and many mysteries in small towns. And then you mention Walter Burkitt, and I go, I read Walter Burkitt 800 years ago, and then Phrygia in Turkey, agriculture and fertility before the Inquisition. Now, let me just toss all that to you. But you say before the Inquisition, it evolved, according to Jesse Weston, into the ceremony of the Grail. So we're moving from Turkey, right?
We're moving from Phrygia, because this is Asia Minor back as it was back in the day, and Phrygians they spoke an Indo-European language. I don't think it's readable now, just. But the mysteries of the Great Mother, the mysteries of Cybele and Attis, were very popular in the Roman world, in the late Greek and the Roman world. They were spread all over the Mediterranean world. They were more portable than some of the other mysteries. They're right up there with the Bacchic mysteries, as far as, you know, you can set them up anywhere. And so people took them up. They spoke to some of the deep needs of the time. And they spread literally all over the Roman world, all the way out to the howling wasteland of Britannia. And so you have this tradition of ritual celebration of the sort of deep messages of consciousness, the deep messages that agricultural fertility has for us. We watch the grain rise in the spring, we watch the harvesters in the fall, we see a cascade of metaphors having to do with our own lives, with our own life and death, with many other things. And we have a ritual to serve as a lens through which to focus that into our awareness. And so that's kind of phase one of this whole process, where you have, and of course many other mystery cults. It was a very standard mode of Greco-Roman spirituality in those days, and not just, one of the crucial things to keep in mind, it was not just the elites. A lot of the mysteries were practiced by ordinary working class people. We know from Athenian records, the Eleusinian mysteries were open to men and women of any social class, slaves. Of course, there were a lot of people, a lot of enslaved people in those days, most of the working class, in fact. And they routinely attended the Eleusinian mysteries, became initiated into them. So it was one of the things that bridged the class barriers, it bridged the gender barriers, it bridged all the various social complexities of this time.
So with the Eleusinian mysteries, I think it was open to men, women, children, slaves. Only if one had committed murder and not atoned was one excluded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was a once-in-a-lifetime thing because it was pricey.
It was kind of pricey, yeah. But you know, there were, you could usually swing something and you save up for a few years. Yeah.
So I don't think you mention the entheogens that they gather at Eleusis and drink this psilocybe ergot brew. Do you mention that?
Well, no. The thing is, nobody quite knows what the what was in the Kaikion that did the strange things. They had this tea that contained some herbs and some barley and some other things. We don't know. John Allegro, of course, there's another name that probably comes to your mind quickly. Has argued that it was probably ergot based, but we don't know. Like so much around the Eleusinian mysteries, it is a mystery in every sense of the word. Were they using, psychedelic drugs? I don't know. Were they doing something else? There are some weird things surrounding the old mystery cults. One of the things if you were in Athens in say the 5th century, and you looked out across the bay, you could see Eleusis way off there in the distance. It's kind of around the curve, and the night of the big deal, the night of the main ceremony, you could see the windows in the Telesterion, the temple of initiation, light up brilliantly, just casting brilliant light all over the place from that kind of distance. How? What was their technology? What was the light from? At a time when most light was like, you know, olive lamps, olive oil lamps. There may have been some very strange things going on. There are some, I mean, one of the things that we have to get past to understand any of this stuff is the notion that we are the first person ever to develop clever technologies. And there's a lot of evidence from a range of sources that there was some kind of knowledge of electricity in ancient times. We have the famous Babylon batteries from the 2nd century BC, or 2nd century AD, excuse me, from Mesopotamia, which are obviously lead-acid batteries. You have two pieces of metal, you have the gunky remains. It probably produced about a volt. There's claims that it was probably used for electroplating cheap jewelry to make it look like gold. So what else might have been going on? Was there electricity involved in alchemy, for example? Were the alchemists actually, you know, doing kind of stealth electroplating and saying, look, I've turned it to gold, or what? We don't know.
That's great. But one of my favorite quotes from Sir Herbert Reed is, only those serving an apprenticeship to nature can be trusted with technology. And what you're delineating is a great deal. This is about environmental accord.
Yeah,
I mean, all of these many myths, from Persephone to Percival to everybody. And then let's go back to, wait, do I say Cybele? How did you pronounce it?
I said it Cybele. Cybele or Cybele.
Cybele, okay.
Cybele, yeah.
So that's pretty cool. And wild, Acessus, who was a man and then a woman.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why, of course, not a lot of people are learned in obscure Mediterranean mythologies, but you'd think that the Cybele mythos would have been taken on by some people in the transgender community these days. It has
definitely
a lot of connections.
Well, no, it's great, and then the woman who was a man falls in love with Cybele, but that takes us to, wait. you'll have to help me segue in your own great work, to Logres and the maidens who were violated by
yes.
King Amongrus and his vassals.
The elucidation, the weirdest of the Arthurian legends, yeah. And this is the timing is actually great here, because I think it was like a year ago, maybe a little more, John and Caitlin Matthews came out with a book called The Secret Book of the Grail, first-rate piece, and it's also unpacking the elucidation, and of course they're taking it in a different direction. They're looking at some of the other currents that fed into it, but it's a good book, and they have, you know, they've got a translation of the elucidation. I've got one in the back of the Ceremony of the Grail. I'm hoping that people start paying more attention to that exceedingly strange document. Yeah, I mean, this is not something you find in any Arthurian source. So, you know, long ago, the land of Logres, you know, was in peace and plenty, and there were these maidens who dwelt either in hills or in wells. You can't tell from the old French word, puis, P-U-I-S. It could mean either one. Go figure. So, but these maidens, if a traveler was traveling along, they could stop at the puy, and the maiden would come forth and feed them and provide them with whatever meals they desired, until Amangons, the wicked king, who was traveling, raped one of the maidens and took her golden bowl from, because they had these golden bowls, and then all of his vassals, seeing that he got away with it, did the same thing, and all the maidens vanished. And the whole thing.
And the land
was led waste. No tree grew, no water flowed, and the court of the rich fisher, which is where all the wealth came from, vanished. Nobody could find it again. And so, yeah, you have this terrifying image of ecological devastation, grappling, you know, gripping the land, and. It doesn't. The elucidation doesn't say what kind of horrid fate befell Amangons, but it says that a horrid fate befell him and his vassals. So we'll take that as given. And then, of course, a long, difficult age passed, and then Arthur became the king of Logres, and of course he called to himself all the bravest and boldest warriors of the land to become knights of his Round Table, and they set out with one accord to. Try to fix the situation, to try to get out there, and you know, if were there, did the maidens have heirs, and did Amangons have and his nasty people have heirs, and we're gonna fix this. We're gonna saddle up and don our shining armor and grab sword and spear and go galloping off into the wasteland to try to solve the problem, and things get complex from there, and. Eventually, in the story, it got fixed, or will get fixed. We can get to that because there's some serious astrology involved here.
Right. No, I love that. I love that. And also, you say the Fellowship of the Round Table swore a mighty oath to restore the wells and defend mm-hmm. the damsels and recover the golden cups, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why we have endogenous receptors to this now, and then mm-hmm. the whole mythos of the positive Mars going. Mm-hmm. You know, away, right? All the kind of hip people leave the court. Arthur goes to, you know, Avalon. I say to take Pilates classes with the priestesses or whatever to await the world's call. You know, mm-hmm. like High John the Conqueror in this country. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know mm-hmm. him, great folk hero.
Oh yes, yeah.
He goes to reside in High John the Conqueror route to await the world's mm-hmm. call. And with Mars going direct, I go now would be really good to come back.
Yeah, although you've got to admit, lots of people have thought that before. And the thing is, to some extent, he's always coming back. He's always, you know, that energy is always flowing. It's just that it waits for us to pick it up or to be picked up by it, and to embody it in the world. That's, you know, that's how archetypes work. They don't do the work themselves. They're waiting for you to you know, open yourself to them.
Right. Yeah, a friend of mine, because my book was called Making the Gods Work for You, he said the gods are willing to do 50%, but not 51%.
Uh-huh,
uh-huh. And we might say that ritual is our way of inviting back into uh-huh. the world. Uh-huh. And the Fellowship of the Round Table. Well, there's a symmetry, right? Because on October 30th, Mars uh-huh. did its station to retrograde, and that was the Brazilian election. Uh-huh. And so it was like, well, what Mars are we electing? And we go, oh, Lula Mars, And Lulamars, because he swore a mighty oath to restore the Amazon, right, in keeping with the Fellowship of the Round Table. And then there's, you know, the Trumpian tyrannical dingbats that we want to, you know, quiet down everywhere and there. But now goes forward. So there's a kind of symmetry to that. And I like thinking of Raphael Warnock as our Black Gospel King Arthur, just because the myths are all around, you know, eager to, you know, myth arriving into incarnational actuality. But yes, so over and over again, you have, you know, and you track it to Japan and Shinto and the whole, well, because animism is endogenous just because, you know, it's true.
That's a straightforward way of putting it, yes.
Yeah.
Well, but the thing is, there's more than just, yes, there's this endogenous factor, but also it's really interesting that you have certain mythic patterns and certain patterns of tradition of folklore that you find at certain points at the two farthest ends of Eurasia. You find things in Japan, you find things in Britain and Ireland. You have similar traditions involving earthen mounds, burial mounds. You have similar traditions involving straight lines radiating out from sacred places. They still put those into Shinto shrines there. You have these legends around the lost cup or the lost bowl. There's something very strange and probably very ancient. One of the things that students of the history of myth have found that in many cases, when you go out to the fringe of the territory, you find things all the way around the fringes that used to be in the center and got sort of driven out to the edges over time. So, yeah.
The edges. Well, we'll get to so many things: the debatable lands, the borderlands, the dangerous things about trees. And then we're going to take a very short break in 2 minutes, but it's very short. So wherever we are, we will resume. But because over and over again, you know, from myths and fairy tales and practices in Japan and in Europe and in Scotland and in Frisia, you know, it's the admonition about don't cut the trees down. You know,
don't
if you cut down an olive tree, we'll kill you.
That was the law in Athens. Yeah.
Yeah. And
in Ireland.
Kind of should be now, but or at least that level of respect, you know, and the necessity in Japan and everywhere, or the mythological moral necessity to plant trees on riverbanks and to have these, and the sacred places are always surrounded by green. Yeah,
exactly. Where if you have a sacred place, you have to have a green belt around it, and you can see that in the Middle Ages, the churchyards around medieval Christian churches very often have big trees growing in them. In some cases, they're the only trees in the area, if it's not an area where trees typically thrive, but you have these churchyard yews and so on. So there is that ancient tradition, and of course that ties into one of my other books, and that's a whole another can of worms.
Yes, and then so there's a lot of, you know, you're talking about, you know, pragmatic mysticism, meaning the myths are telling us the temple technology to increase the fertility of the land. This is practical stuff.
And not necessarily, you know, we think of, well, it's woo-woo. Well, no. There's good reason to think that the specific thing that I was writing about in my book, The Secret of the Temple, the temple technology, is actually using known physical forces. It's not spiritual extent to the extent that everything is spiritual. But we're talking about telluric electricity. We're talking about high-frequency microwaves. I've got more research along these lines continuing, and it looks as though what's going on is a low energy maser. A maser is a microwave laser. It basically produces microwaves at a particular frequencies that are determined by the mix of volatile organic compounds in the air. Volatile organic compounds is spelled incense, by the way. The shape of the resonating chamber, that's spelled temple. The particular kinds of sound waves that are used to stir the thing into motion, that's called chanting, as I'm sure you have guessed, and so on and so forth. It's quite a straightforward system to generate these microwaves that have certain effects on plants and also on pest insects. Very straightforward.
No, that's great. Okay, we're going to take
we're going to
our
go
very
for that
short
break.
Break. We're going to take a very short break, but also, but yes, the shape of the cauldrons at the temple of people listening to the wind in Dion. Anyway, we have so much to come back to. This is a rich, rich thing. I want to read everything you've ever written.
Thank
our
you.
Guest is John. I do. I'm re-inspired. It's like I haven't been serious enough. I want to be like John Michael Greer. He's really delved. So our wonderful guest is John Michael Greer. Again, the book we are honoring is The Ceremony of the Grail, Ancient Mysteries, Gnostic Heresies, and the Lost Rituals of Freemasonry. I'm Caroline Casey, and we'll be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellation and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his torus cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Ooh, chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our more than perfect, splendid, erudite guest is John Michael Greer, author of over 50 books on esoteric traditions, whose resonant erudition is expressed in his latest book, The Ceremony of the Grail. His website is echosophia.net. No, it's really great because you're touching on so much and in fact, you know, resonating. And may it be for all of us that we go, I was interested in that. I remember that. Even I had the great good luck at my school. You know, Jack Langstaff ran the music department in grade school, mm-hmm. and he gave us Morris dancing and paganism and St. George being killed at the end of the year. He was disguised as a teacher, but he was really the arch druid of McLean, Virginia. and so I remember all that, and the doctor coming to heal the St. George who's died. Anyway, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are back here.
So you say.
Yeah, after the long and bitter age past King Arthur and the Fellowship. But then you also talk about the mysteries. I guess we're going to go back to Dodona, the Greek oracles, priestesses who learned to listen to the wind in the leaves,
mm-hmm.
amplified by cauldrons. Woo!
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And beyond Dodona, the goddess of the oaks.
Generally speaking, I wonder how many people realize that so much of what was done in ancient Greek life was based on paying attention to the natural world in certain kind of formal structured settings, whether it's going to Dodona, where the priestesses are listening to the wind and the doves, whether it's going to every third town had its own oracle, and most of them involved dealing either with natural phenomena or like the one, oh, I forget where it was that Pausanias talks about this one. You go into the temple, you make your offering, plug your ears with your fingers. You walk out of the temple into the agora. You open your ears, and the first words you hear are the answer to your question. So you're actually paying attention to what people don't usually notice. But so all of this, you're tapping into the speech of the world. And the natural world, because human beings are part of the natural world. We're not isolated from them. The Greeks understood that. Most of us have kind of forgotten that, but the Greeks understood that. So they were literally letting the wisdom of everyday life, of life in the world, guide them in these very interesting kind of divinatory methods.
Well, and it's a keeper of a larger truth. I mean, just that resonates again in our endogenous receptors, that we live in a storytelling and conversational creation. That everything's conversing, converse, turning together. By shape, color, song, wind. And if we humans, here we go, just approach the world with informed, reverent curiosity, we'd be okay, right?
Yeah, the world's talking to us all the time. We just have to learn to listen to it. And yeah, that's I didn't get into that in this book. There's another book that I'm building toward right now. Some posts on my blog and so on, talking about how civilizations gradually move away from listening to the world and just listen to themselves. And, you know, you get this increasingly complex built environment, which is what? It's the projections of our own thought forms. Somebody had to think of a skyscraper or a condo block or this kind of stuff. That it's the human imagination, but it's a particular kind of imagination, a culturally shaped imagination. And so civilizations do this, and this is how they sort of drift away from engaging the world, from listening to the world. And that's also, of course, how they fall. Because civilizations do, they always do. And so, you know, that's just watching that process, you can see the sort of Amangons mentality of, no, I'm not going to be receptive. I'm not going to sit here and be grateful that the maiden from the well is going to, you know, offer me a nice meal. I'm going to take what I want. And that's, you know, that Amangons consciousness is, of course, very much part of our modern world. It's part of, every civilization as it gets... as it passes that point of losing track of the need to listen and says, no, you know, the Roman Empire will last forever. We are imposing our will upon the world. And if the world doesn't like it, it can lump it. Well, you know, the world had a few tricks up its sleeve.
Right. And maybe also we can just be reminded of Mercury retrograde to remember to listen.
To remember to listen, yeah.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's stationing point. And then when it will station on the 18th at 8 plus Capricorn, which is where Eris was when the country was founded, that image is an angel carrying a harp. And we go, all right, it's an angel carrying a harp with a quiver filled with arrows, each one tipped with combat. We have lots of skills with which to participate. And then these forks in the road, I'm not sure if you say it this way, but I remember somebody saying, you know, we want to go back to like when the Greeks ditched most of their animal gods, right, and went to just human. Is that a thought that you have?
It's not one of mine, but it's a worthwhile point. It's something you actually see that in many cultures where, yeah, there's that fixation on the human as opposed to the animal or the semi-animal. The Egyptians, they were very good at keeping that animal presence by having their very animal-headed deities and animal-formed deities. So,
right, and then over and over again in so many examples that we want to honor and take to our hearts, you know, even like animistic places, and I'm also thinking of Bali, you know, where the alleged green revolution came in, and you silly superstitious peasants, you don't need to do this, you can get more harvest out of this, and what are these temples doing, you know, are these shrines at the where water flows into the fields, you don't need that, you know, and it's like, and then afterwards some of them were like, oh, those were good ideas. Well, ritual, yeah. Ritual and environmental preservation, right? That's a whole part of your offering.
Exactly. The traditional agriculture of any part of the world has usually been honed for millennia to work extremely well in the conditions you have there. And then you get a bunch of heavily educated idiots. Was it Taleb, I think, was talking about intellectual yet idiot as a basic category of modern life, people who are very educated and very intelligent, but totally cut off from the realities of life. And so they go around saying things, I'm pretty sure that was Nassim Nicholas Taleb. They go around saying and doing and teaching things that are simply idiotic. And so, we had a lot of that in the Green Revolution. We have a lot of it now. What can you say?
Well, you have a lot to say. But I loved several miles back you were talking about, something related to, humbled by the intelligence of others. I mean, our ancestors, our mentors, and the intelligence of nature. And I think that's a crucial thing right now for, because of the word human comes from humus, which means dirt, from which we get humble. Yeah. We're meant to be humble people in the dirt. And to be humbled by the intelligence of what's come before us and the intelligence of the wind and to listen. And as you... Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
No, just to understand that the people who lived in past times were not morons just because they lived before us. That's the mythology of progress, the notion that we're smarter than anyone else because we have so many neat toys. And this proves that we can ignore everything that came before us. It's a really, really delusional notion, and yet it guides so many people's actions these days. A certain amount of humility, a certain amount of respect, a capacity for admiration. Rudolf Steiner talks about that if you don't have a capacity for admiration, you can't actually learn anything.
Right, and skillful use of the word delusional, which comes from deludo, which means out of the game.
Out of the game, so,
yeah. Yeah, as opposed to illusion.
I did not happen to know that. Fascinating. Okay.
Isn't that wonderful? Well, and then illusion in Ludo is in the game, right?
In the game.
And that's what your dedication to, you know, myths and stuff, these illusions and fluctuating metaphors for as ways of participating with reality means we're in the game. We're in the infinite game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Delusion, out of the game.
Out of the game. So on the sidelines, the guy.
and then just to toss back to you, you know, all these, you say religions of nature, and we go, yes, we want that we remember this. And I remember hearing E.O. Wilson speak at the cathedral in Washington, D.C., and at that time, he said, you know, I'm a hard-nosed Harvard scientist, but I'm hanging out with all these evangelical Christians who are different, and our conversation is useful. He said, you know, in 100 years we can disagree, but now we have a common task to save the Earth. And he said, you know, and he said, what I as a scientist get from my conversations is, you know, skip the orthodoxy, but it's going to take a religious fervor to organize us, to mobilize, to be respectful.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's an important point, and yet, it's been made over and over again for the last, certainly well over a half century now. But the problem that I've seen in most attempts to turn a sort of religious consciousness toward nature is that a lot of the people who are pushing it don't actually believe in themselves. They think it'd be really great if other people were to believe these things. And it's a reminder that religions can't be made up. You know, religions are born out of personal spiritual experience. They're born out of, well, Rudolf Otto, the mysterium tremendum et fascinans. You're hit by it. You're shaken by it right down to your souls. You have this encounter with something that is not you and is not obedient to your desires, and that has a message or a mission for you. And that becomes something out of which a religious experience takes shape. That becomes something out of which a religion can be born. If it's just intellectuals sitting around going, well, you know, it'd be really nice if there was a religion in nature, that doesn't get far.
Right.
So we've got to get out of study. We've got to get out of that sort of, out of being out of the game, out of sitting back and looking at it at a distance. We actually have to get out there into the work of religious experience, and that often means, you know, spiritual practices.
And then just to toss back some of your finely honed phrases, I've got yellow markers all kind of everywhere. in this great book, let me remember, The Ceremony of the Grail by John Michael Greer, it's rich, rich. Every chapter could be a chapter of your life. but you say, imagine furthermore that some of these technologies have to do with parts of human experience that our culture denies and rejects.
Uh-huh.
Aspects of the cosmos that have been ruled off limits for centuries by rationalists and religious authorities alike. And we go, right, the reality police, the reality police.
The reality police.
So because
the world is,
you make
the world is a weird
place. Oh, sorry, back to you.
The world is a weird place. It is not, it, no one set of filters, no one set of, no one belief system can account for everything in the world. If there's just too much, I mean, our brains are not that big. We're not that smart. The universe, I mean, the human brain is, what, 6 inches long? The universe is how many hundred quadrillion light years across? One of these cannot understand the other. So we just need to get used to the fact the world is weirder than we can imagine, and that we need to be open to the possibility there are things going on that our particular reality filter can't cope with. Now, go on. Back to you.
Or may it be so after, you know, welcomes. Now welcomes. All right, there. As a fun thing, but And then just to, you know, just to, zigzagging here, but you speak about the temple technology, and you say its goals were not oriented to bountiful harvests. Its purpose was nothing less than the prolongation of human consciousness beyond physical death.
That's not the temple technology. That's another technology. That's the technology of the burial mounds. That's the technology.
Right. Okay. Yes.
No, the temple technology is that has agricultural fertility, as well as quite possibly certain transmutations of consciousness among the living, as its effect. I mean, magnetic fields will do strange things to the human mind. But no, the mound technology that we see in burial mounds in Europe, we see it in burial mounds in Japan. We see it in its finest form in the Egyptian pyramids. That's, you know, whether or not you believe that it could work, this was certainly done for that purpose. And there's a very long and rich body of lore that's been gathered over the years about how they used to do that. I'm hoping that our current population of obscenely rich plutocrats is not listening, because the last thing we need is a bunch of them building pyramids and trying to prolong their consciousness after death.
Right. We have Las Vegas. But also I love that, like last week's guest, who wrote We the Elites, you know, dissecting and diagnosing the Constitution. I said to him, and I now said to you, I love reading these books in which I go, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Yeah, and your book is full of that. Japan was full of standing stones and earth burial mounds all over the place. I didn't know that.
This was something I didn't used to know that, but I was on the one hand, back in the mid to late 1970s, as a kid underfoot, I was reading all these books on earth mysteries, reading books by John Michel, reading so on. Alfred Watkins, all this kind of stuff.
Yes.
And then because my step family is Japanese American. And so I ended up absorbing from my stepmother's side a lot of Japanese culture. I was very interested in that, and I started running across a lot of the same things going on in Japanese folk religion, and where you have, you know, the central line of a Shinto shrine. You don't stand on it, and it goes out through the torii gates and typically extends for quite a ways across the landscape in a dead straight line, and there's some kind of energy that flows along it. That's the tradition. So I'm going, I have heard this line before, so to speak. pun not intended. But yeah, so there's a lot of this book. This I could not have written this book 10 years ago, and 20 years ago I would have had no clue. But it's been something that's been building for a very long time, out of many of the different fields of research that interest me.
Right. No, and it's so, you know, maybe for all of us, in a way, all of our different affinities as clues to be honored. And so I had a deep date with Japanese culture, mostly the Heian period, right? Lady Murasaki, the novels, the first novels being written were by women. And in The Tale of Genji, right, everything is art, you know, and meaningful symbolism. And it's so exquisite. And I go, God, I love this, and I love the Middle East. You know, what is the thing? Mm-hmm. And in Hansen's History of Japan, the first opening paragraph says, "There's no exquisite aesthetic comparable to the Heian period of Japan, except in the Ottoman Empire in Turkey." And I go, oh, I'm tracking the same thing. I'm tracking, different expressions.
Okay, yeah.
But you talk about Kobo Daishu.
Kobo Daishi, yes.
The
founder of Shingon Buddhism, which was not coincidentally the kind of Buddhism that my stepfamily practices. So I had kind of an in there. Interestingly, Manly P. Hall, there's a grand old name. He was initiated into Shingon Buddhism. One of his little booklets that you get from the PRS is about his trip to Koyasan, to their headquarters in Japan. So if you read Manly P. Hall closely, you can often find references to Shingon concepts. He was brilliant, and he drew heavily from every... I mean, lots of people were talking about, well, yeah, we need to unite the spiritual thought of the East and the West, and, you know, Manly Hall, he's not going to sit there and go, yeah, what a great idea. So he goes and gets himself initiated and studies Shingon Buddhism as a way to, having previously studied Rosicrucianism and all this kind of stuff, as a way to actually make that bridge. So... Hall
and also just for in our festival here, Manly P. Hall does a film introduction to this 1938 film, which is an astrological detective film. It's really great. Ooh. With Anna May Wong, called When Were You Born? And Manly P. Hall does the intro. And
okay.
Astrology
I'm going to hunt that puppy down. Thank you.
I'll send it to you. Because my great backstage badger found it. I'll send it to you. It's really good. And she does solve the crime astrologically and is given her props. Anyway,
sweet.
And Manly P. Hall does that too. So it's very darling. There's a code. Okay, and again, there's so much. This is why I do yearn to have this be part one, John Michael Greer, because there's so much here.
We can certainly talk further about that. Yeah, I know. You can't get through this in an hour.
No, and we're going to skip Richard Wagner for a moment anyway. Back to Mars as Percival as Mars. Can we do a brief precession of the equinoxes followed by William Morris?
Well, yeah, one of the things that really struck me, because I've done a lot of reading in processional stuff, of course, Hamlet's Mill. I've actually wore out one copy of that, and I am on my second copy. But getting the sense, you know, here you have all these hero gods that typically have, Kullervo, I think it was, in the Finnish one, his evil uncle. They always have evil uncles. The evil uncle tried to drown him, and the evil uncle goes back, and his henchmen go back to the seashore, and he has not drowned. The hero child is sitting on the water, and he's measuring the entire ocean with a ladle, and it comes to a little over 2 ladles. So what measures the great deep in a little over 2 measures? Mars, with his orbital cycle of 2.2 years. All very straightforward, but the Mars hero is always a total idiot when he's young. He's always, he's young, he's strong, he has a brain of total brick, and just stumbles straight through everything, and eventually, you know, he becomes wise, he gets a clue eventually, and that's Percival all over the place.
right, and it's, I love that when Hercules, a kind of Mars, is a young idiot destroying the world, the gods get together and they sentence him to go to the underworld to learn knitting and weaving.
That's
excellent.
Yeah.
I think that's an option for the criminal looters that we see around us.
They should
go learn
knitting and weaving. Exactly. Learn what it takes to actually make something. To actually make something that takes time and patience. And learn to focus your will.
Right. I had a brief Aleister Crowley horrible flashback to the left, right? But I just got rid of it there. There we go. So, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the... Well, because many of us who started off, you know...
Cabbage that thou wilt shall be the coal of the slaw.
Ooh, okay. moving right along, but we can come back to some of these things. But you do a really clear explanation of the precession of the equinoxes and the cultural mythology that goes with that. And that 5,000 years ago, we were in sync. That on the equinox you would see the sun against the constellation Aries.
You wouldn't see it because Aries was behind the sun. That's one of the tricks there, you see. And that's, as I pointed out in the book, all of this stuff in the elucidation about how the court of the Fisher King could not be found. What's the court of the Fisher King in the zodiac? It's the sign Pisces. And at the spring equinox for the last 2,000 years, no, it couldn't be found. Because the sun's covering it, it's off behind the sun. So we're now, as the sun slides, into Aquarius, we're now at the point where the court of the Fisher King can be found again, if we have some people who are willing to swear that mighty oath and, ride forth into the wasteland looking.
And ask the right question. The quest
and
begins
ask
with questions.
The right question.
Mm-hmm. So it's 72 years for the sun's position at equinox and solstice to shift by 1 degree.
1 degree.
And 29,950 years for the sun to complete complete zodiacal swing. very clear. And then the archaic star lore that the great spiritual powers or intelligences known as planets are the seven guardians of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what a relief. Yeah. And then I don't think we have time to go into Mabon and the Mabinogion, but we'll do that next time.
We're going to do that next time, yeah.
Right, but I do want to, because at the end, you or medium end, William Morris. Let's honor him in our last 3 minutes.
William Morris, so talented that, I mean, what couldn't he do? I don't think he was a very good portrait painter. I don't think he ever wrote a play. Other than that, I can't think of anything the man couldn't do in creative terms. Just a titan of his time, and of course one of the leading socialists of early, of his period of English culture, very much interested in improving the lot of working folk.
Right.
And and when he was tired and ill at the end of his life and didn't have anything better to do, he invented modern fantasy fiction, just to give himself something
right.
to do. Just
and that's the well.
And his, The well at the world's end. You have to get used to his prose because it is Victorian. It does have that kind of old-fashioned, forsoothly medieval flavor. But it's brilliant stuff. And yeah, the Well at the World's End contains some critical clues. I was astounded. You know, I'd been studying Jesse Weston. I had finally tracked down a copy of her story / essay, The Ruined Temple, which I also have as an appendix in here. And I was going, hold it, this is familiar. Why is this familiar? Oh, my God. Of course, another thing that was going on in the 1970s was the fantasy revival. You had Lynn Carter, blessed be his memory, editing and releasing through Ballantine all of these old fantasy classics that nobody had heard of. And Morris was among them. He got, I think, almost every fantasy. I think he got all of Morris's fantasy in print. And The Well at the World's End, you know, two-volume set, was one of them. And I was just going, okay, yes, it is. Morris clearly had access to some of this material. How did he get it? Where did he find this?
We're going to have to wait for next. For
we're
next,
going to have to wait. We're going
next
to leave
week's
that
exciting episode.
Yeah.
Right? Or we will think of this as our
next thrilling episode of Search for the Grail.
Exactly. We're going to do that. Thank you so much. This is part one. Again, we will reschedule him in February. Absolutely. But thank you so much, John Michael Greer. Great book, Ceremony of the Grail. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. And thanks always to Kristen Thomas on the board. And we will... CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Woof, woof, woof. Thanks again, John Michael.